to Third Culture Therapy, a podcast that looks at the unique ways our social identity and cultural heritage impact our mental and emotional well-being. I'm Leila Magribi, writer, journalist, and host of this show. In this series, I'll be exploring how our multiple, sometimes conflicting identities affect how we feel about ourselves and the world around us. Through interviews with people from various backgrounds, I'll be delving into the vastly different journeys taken in the pursuit of inner wellness and find out what aspects of their culture have had a positive and negative impact on their mental health. Welcome to the show, dear listeners. On this episode, I'm speaking to Tanya, a wonderfully insightful professional coach specializing in emotional intelligence, who talks to me about why having a high EQ is important to improving our inner well-being and the world around us. So let me start with telling you a little bit about my lovely guest. Tanya Kojaste is an Iranian-Canadian, almost British, entrepreneur and educator with 20 years' experience providing teaching and training programs in the education and corporate sectors. Tanya left her birthplace of Iran when she was 10 years old and moved to Canada with her mother and brother. They were fleeing the Iran-Iraq war and remained in the North American country after the conflict ended. In her college years, Tanya faced some inner struggles that led her to look more closely at the traumas of her childhood. It opened her mind to a world in which emotions were central to the understanding and regulating of the inner self. As a business owner, Tanya has put emotional intelligence at the heart of her work. For the past decade, her company, Uber Tutors, has been offering tailored and online private tutoring with a high dose of emotionally intelligent coaching. Her passion for learning and psychology are central to her company, Fearless Knowledge, an academy and consultancy that provides intersectional emotional and social intelligence training. She also hosts a podcast by the same name and on the same topics, with a focus on fear and fearlessness. Tanya, thank you very much for joining me in this podcast series, Third Culture Therapy. It's a pleasure to have you.
Wow, Leila, thank you so much for that introduction.
It's impressive, huh?
Apologies in advance that it's a little bit long, but I really appreciate you trying to fit in my background and my passion for emotional intelligence and a bit of my entrepreneurialism. It's such an honor to be on Third Culture Therapy. I love the name, by the way, Leila. It's beautiful.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah. Yes, I think so. And you're definitely, I think, fit into the mold of the third culture kid, as we call them. You and I, you know, we got to know each other through our mutual friend, Ali Khan, who is also co-host of Fearless Knowledge podcast. Is that right?
Yay. Yes. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Love Ali. Have been longtime friends with him. The podcast came as a result of my second company, which is called Fearless Knowledge, which you mentioned in your intro. So it's based off of the emotionally intelligent training that we do for professionals and for young people. But I really also wanted to have a really friendly conversation version of the topics that we talk about in those trainings with a friend of mine, Ali, who is obviously one of my most trusted and probably emotionally intelligent also colleagues and friends.
What are the topics that you explore on Fearless Knowledge?
Fearless Knowledge as a name, when I was sort of founding the company and the idea and the podcast, is all about becoming fearless in our knowing, in our knowledge, in our conscientious learning. So the topics are directly about fear and fearlessness as it relates to anything and everything within ourselves or internal personal development work, psychologically, to mental health, to societal and political issues, and to the intersections of them all, essentially. So emotionally intelligent society to the self, if I were to kind of sum it up.
Very relevant to obviously what I'm discussing here, but also just relevant to everyone at the moment, I feel. And I think you'll agree with me. There's a lot of inner work being done and that needs to be done throughout the world. And the sense of self and identity and mental and emotional stability has really been tested post-pandemic. And really, as we are quite aware, we are going through a mental health crisis globally. So having this information out there that people can relate to is incredibly important. What drew you to this field and psychology?
I think, as we always say in the world of psychology, everything comes back to your childhood in some ways. So I think if I were to go back that far, I would say I was born and raised in Iran initially, and then migrated to Canada, and then thereafter migrated to England. And I now live and work in London. I think the migration process has been one of the probably most, let's just say, insightful and learning experiences of my life from childhood onwards. And I also grew up in Iran at a time when the Iran-Iraq war was happening. So I'm that xenial kid, as we say, born in the 1980s and experiencing that firsthand in my childhood. And I think the conflicts that were both happening externally, politically, and outside of my door with bombs exploding like on the streets, to the experiences in my household with my parents also having conflict and our extended family also obviously being in great turbulence during that time. All of that kind of chaos, I would say, was emotional chaos. And it got me from a very early age paying attention and being really observant to the dynamics that were happening in the emotional human world. And I wanted answers to things. And so, interestingly, years later, when we moved to Canada, when I was about 10 years old, I had to then do a lot of cultural assimilation, if you like, and had faced some difficulties in adjusting, obviously learning a new language, being a really shy kid at the time, and also being really vulnerable coming from that kind of chaotic experience and feeling almost attacked also by the children, by the young people in Canada who were like not understanding me, and I was not understanding them maybe so much either. And that adjustment and growth that I had to do was a severe growing pain, which then led to some years later, me having to do some aspects of therapy and really starting actually my journey into studying human behavior and emotional intelligence, psychology, doing some psychotherapy at the time. And so I got a really early start at a time when these things were actually stigmatized and I was just a teenager. And I think all of that kind of opened up my mind and my world, like my worldview to understanding human behavior and understanding human emotions that lead to their behavior and wanting answers. But interestingly or ironically, I also wanted to, I was one of these kids that was like, I need to do things in my career or in my life that actually ends up solving some issues in the world, you know, like we all know of those kids who are in school and wanting to save the world. I was one of them. So
save the world. Yeah, I know. I definitely was one of them too. Yeah.
So I ended up studying political science and international relations in my undergrad and my master's, and then later on doing a law degree in the hope that I think these degrees or these education backgrounds would somehow answer these questions for me of why there's so much turbulence or emotional turbulence in the world, which then adds up to a lot of injustice and the corruptions and the problems that we see. But I think to come full circle, I realized in the last decade that actually the answer lies with what my initial love was, which was the study of psychology and the study of emotions and the human behavior. Because at the end of the day, if we don't understand humans, we don't understand their decisions, and we don't understand the justice or injustice that they are causing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, you describe something that is unfortunately these days all too prevalent, but this conflict, war, fleeing that, first of all, experiencing it and the violence that you obviously witnessed and experienced, but then also the rupture with your place, your home, your country, friends, family, a move to an entirely different and new environment. Do you recall at the time how you experienced it, how your feelings about it were? Did any anxiety or inner conflict manifest then? Or do you think on reflection it came out after?
Yeah, really good question. I think if you're referring to my like childhood experience when the war and the issues were happening, yes, absolutely. I don't know how to explain it, but I was like a really shy, introverted kid that was absorbing almost too much information about violence. And so at the time, I just had so many questions. And one of the questions that I actually mentioned with Ellie on our podcast one time was, one of the questions I feel like I had as a kid is, why is the world so unempathetic? Why am I, as a little girl in this house, living with my parents and with my grandparents, feeling so much fear, you know, that I will be at any moment maybe killed. You know, bombs were blowing over our head and there was a war that was going on for 8 years. And every day felt like a war zone in our lives. It was very vivid and very visceral. And there were sirens going off. So that it's just unimaginable. I think people, especially in the Western world, don't necessarily appreciate sometimes when we say, oh, these people are immigrants in our society. I think they really don't viscerally imagine what has happened to these people and how their innocence has been violated, and that they're coming sometimes with some of that, for lack of better words, we call it trauma, but they're coming with shock about human beings to their new homes or to their new society. And so, yeah, I started to feel all of those things from childhood. Of course, also, like I mentioned, no external chaotic world like has a calm world internally. I mean, my family's beautiful and they're loving and they're kind and they're Persian, so they definitely know how to be giving and generous. But at the same time, I think chaos outside leads to chaos inside. And my parents were also having a difficult time within their relationship and within the family dynamics, and they wanted to separate perhaps. And so like experiencing all of that too, you know, in the inside of my house. And then on top of it, I also come from a society and a time generationally where there was a lot of pressure even on girls to be super educated and to be highly achieved. My parents were both doctors, and they also put that burden also on top of it. Like, it doesn't matter if there's war going on the outside and there's sirens and alarms going off, and you're going to school and you're getting an A++++, and you're going to be the class representative, and we're only going to hear amazing things about you, and because we need you to also be a doctor professor. Okay? The end.
Like, no pressure. Wow.
No pressure, child. And there was a lot of also, yeah, so there was a heavy level of pressure, I think, emotionally on this little child, little Tanya, growing up in that world. And I think that's where it all began. But then, like I said, it took a whole different other almost like escalation and journey, where now you take this little girl coming from that background and put them into a new society where the children are almost like the flip opposite absurd in some ways, because, you know, in the school that I went to when I just entered, these 10, 11 year old kids were like just so much more confident, let's just say, and outward and expressive. And they knew about sex and things that I had no idea about coming from like the background that I came from. So it was also a shell shock in a different way. And I also had to adjust. Like, I didn't understand the language for a long time. I had to learn it pretty quickly. I'm pretty sure I managed to speak English out of fear probably within 6 months, just because, yeah. So a lot of my life, when I look back in those growing years, fundamentally, if I were to address one main emotion behind it, it would be fear. And I think it's probably maybe a similar experience for a lot of people coming from those kind of more turbulent background experiences from childhood onwards, especially for, you know, migrant children. Fear is really core to the heart of what probably, you know, we all felt and feel. And then I wanted to always study fear. I wanted to understand how one overcomes their fears, essentially, that shape them.
That is so much to go through at any age, let alone as a child. And I'm curious to know how, if at all, that was addressed by adults around you, by caregivers, by your parents, by family, by teachers. Were there ever any conversations addressing sort of the internal impact of the external? So I assume, similar to my family and others who come from sort of conflict places, that the discussion on like what's happening in the news was probably 24/7.
Exactly.
So you could probably count exactly how many rockets were fired or shells dropped or people killed. How much discussion was there about, well, how are you feeling about this? And what does this mean? You know, you said you had a lot of questions, like, why are people like this? What conversations were there?
Again, such a good question. It makes me laugh or smile internally, because like none. Never. We have to be quote unquote strong. And part of that description of strong means like almost the repressed masculine version of strong, which means don't ask really good, vulnerable questions. Don't show vulnerability. Just take all of that information that you're being bombarded with, including the statistics on the amount of bodies that are dying around you and the neighborhood and the things that are being destroyed, and repress it, you know, get sad, but then get on with it, go do your math work, homework, you know, and get an A, you have a test tomorrow. So there wasn't really a lot of space as far as I can remember, but obviously maybe I'm wrong. Maybe my memory is obviously not serving me well because I can't remember everything from my childhood, but I don't recall having any of those conversations directly anyway. But I think it was also understood within at least my family that we're all facing chaos. And so we all need support, but how to be there, especially for children, was almost like not an immediate priority because everyone was dealing with the chaos.
Absolutely. And then that is often, you know, the real tragedy is that it, what is left to give when you are also facing that same trauma and difficulties, and you're often in such a survivalist mode that unfortunately these things like your fears and your feelings are considered or seen to be like a luxury that you really can't afford to indulge in, right? Like we need to just figure out we're going to get bread without getting shot, or if we're going to emigrate, for example, as you did. But how much as well do you think that also relates culturally? So what I mean to say is, if there hadn't been conflict, what is it like in Persian culture to discuss these things and to be open about vulnerabilities and about fears and about traumas or the like?
I think it's complicated. I mean, yeah, I can't generalize because growing up, I realized that my family isn't exactly a sample of all families or all structures within Persian culture. And there's so much diversity there. And I appreciate that. So I think generally speaking, there is and there isn't openness, culturally speaking, because we are and have been, like all other cultures, evolving. What I mean by that is maybe in my family growing up, because both of my parents were from a background where you had to be strong and accomplished and educated and all of these things. And for that, that required a strong sense of not opening up actually that way and having vulnerability emotionally and just getting on with things. And they passed that on certainly to me, which then became a part of my internal struggle in the later years, which I then had to overcome and learn to become more vulnerable and have conversations and express myself. And it's still a journey. I'm still working on it. I mean, I might even have two companies around this stuff, but it's still such a deep and lifetime journey to become vulnerable. If it's hard for me as an individual, I can imagine how long it takes for cultures to evolve that way. But basically, yeah, in my family, we certainly didn't have a lot of that. But interestingly, we did have a huge sense of love around us, though, whatever that kind of means. If I were to like unpack it, that would mean, you know, there was a lot of care. There was a lot of affection. There was a lot of availability to take care of each other, especially when we were like really struggling with things. But I think, you know, was there ever conversation around chaos? Probably best avoided or deflected.
Yeah, I can completely relate to what you're saying. And I wonder how much of that is a case of culture, you know, from the sort of Eastern aspect and or conflict culture. So when I think about my parents, and they come from fortunately, a variety of conflict-ridden countries, Syria, Libya, Palestine. And while I grew up in a place that was obviously very physically safe, when I reflect on, you know, talking about emotions and emotionality and all and vulnerabilities, it was a no-go area, much like you've sort of described. And I've often reflected on what, you know, where does that come from and why? And I theorize that it's, you know, it's a case of control, right? You come from a place where there is, you are essentially deprived of any control when your life is in danger or you've been made a refugee. And, you know, there is this prevalent view that being emotional and tapping into that means you're actually going to lose even more control. While now I recognize that that's not necessarily the case, it doesn't need to be the case at all. It often is the opposite. But I recall, you know, in my household, being vulnerable was equated with weakness. And that's the last thing you want to be when you're an immigrant trying to find your feet and you've already been robbed of all strength by virtue of being exiled or, you know, facing conflict. So I completely relate and understand that sense of as an adult really learning that actually it's not weakness and that I'm not going to suddenly have the ground open up underneath me if I sort of let out these feelings and these thoughts that are disturbing. But yeah, it's a difficult, as you say, an ongoing process.
Ongoing. And the interesting thing is, I mean, especially as like a kid that was getting prepared to move to Canada, I imagined Canadian society as being this like white society that was going to do a much better job at these things. Like, I imagine that I'm now going to move to Canada where these people are going to be, you know, because that's the rhetoric that we're taught, right? As the people that have been formerly colonized, we look at our the Western world and those societies as having done a much better job in understanding human feelings, human behavior, human rights. But it turned out actually in my experience that maybe to some extent, these societies in the West also understand the latter, so human rights, but there's much, much, much avoidance on things like human emotions and human behavior still. That was actually the big learning, like the big, big learning that I did growing up in Canada. Because I realized actually, you know, as like a society, Canada in the 90s or in the millennium, at the time when I was living there, was doing it a semi-decent job in understanding human rights and maybe refugee rights or migrant rights to some extent. But if I actually opened up and started talking to, let's just say, my teachers about my feelings or my emotions, that was not really well accepted, let's just say. And it was at best deflected. And it made me feel like I was actually, I didn't have a right to talk about these things, or I made people uncomfortable. And certainly the other kids my age in school or wherever, different environments, didn't know how to also be vulnerable or like talk that way too. So I realized actually that the societies that like both Iran and Canada were actually not that different.
When you arrived there as a child who's just fled war and left, you know, what she knows behind, did anyone from sort of within the bureaucratic system or education system address those issues, address that emotional toll that it, you know, undoubtedly would have been taking?
No, absolutely not. And I was growing up at this age, so I was, you know, 10, 11 years old, so I would have remembered. No, definitely not within the school system, which I think is really problematic. And to this day, I still work in the education system and I work with schools, and I know that there's very, very little support around those kinds of real things, like really emotionally stabilizing sessions, trainings, conversations, whatever you want to call it. But at the same time, I mean, there was a little bit of support in the sense that like my school principal at the time when I was enrolling and maybe my ESL teacher was somewhat compassionate, I would say, or kind of understood maybe why I'm being shy and a bit reserved. And there was nothing visceral like or tangible that I could say was there, but I could feel that they were okay, a little bit empathetic, a little bit kind towards me and children like me in the school. But outside of that, there wasn't, for example, any kind of program where I was sent to learn along with my English classes about like the things that I might be experiencing. These things definitely didn't exist back then. And in fact, part of the things that I haven't told you, Leila, is that I also am a trustee for a charity here in London where we do exactly this. The newcomer young children who come to UK schools, we actually provide programs that integrate both these teachings, these life skill teachings and like vulnerability expression, articulation, mentorship, counseling, all of these things with English language teaching.
Wow, that's incredible.
It's really incredible. It's truly incredible. So I suppose I should give a shout out to Springboard Youth Academy too for anyone listening, because I think that's an incredible charity and it really remedies that gap because there is such a lack of modeling elsewhere in other systems of migration and the education system in the West. It's just not a thing that exists yet, but I hope that that changes.
How difficult, if at all, was balancing your Persian identity with your Canadian one? Was there like an easy integration? Did you feel that they were separated?
Yes and no is the short of it. I think because, like I said, I was kind of driven out of fear or whatever to learn English as soon as possible. But thank goodness I had the, I guess, motivation somehow, or I suppose the educated background, frankly, to be able to do that. You know, I see a lot of children having a really hard time assimilating through language, into English language. And it takes them a long time. Sometimes it's just an emotional anxiety thing that happens. Sometimes it's the child's like educational background that does that. For me, it was, in quotations, easier to do because of the background that I came from. You know, my parents had insisted that I'm a like A++++ student and that I do my best in everything. So, you know, God forbid I didn't learn English fast so that I can also help my parents and translate everything for them, including very high level administrative bureaucratic documents.
Yes, that'll chestnut. Yes, we are all our immigrant parents' private secretaries in Africa.
Translators, lawyers, like, you know, you name it, everything. So, and I think that like, you know, helps you in a sense doing so much. Yes, you're integrating, but you're integrating because you have to do it. You have to assimilate, not on behalf of yourself as a child. You're doing it on behalf of your family and their well-being, and you're saving them. Essentially, you become their translator, their lawyer, their administrator, their secretary, their everything. And you're handholding your parents. My mom was a single mother at this stage of my life in my teen years in Canada. She was having her own very difficult assimilation process. She was a highly educated, highly experienced doctor. And in Canada, she was regarded as nothing, really, like just unskilled, inexperienced, according to the Canadian laws. And at the same time, she had two young children that she had to take care of, and she had to feed, and she had to raise, and have a shelter over, and educate, and all of that. So she was having a really difficult time integrating into that society, and there wasn't much support for her. And of course, because there wasn't any support for her, and I had to be her everything, I had to grow up a lot faster in a lot of ways. But at the same time, I was also a teenager, and I wanted to hang out with my friends, you know, like my cooler, more confident friends who were doing rebellious, awful things. Staying up till like late at night, probably, like, you know, drinking a little bit illegally. And that was a culture shock to my mom that I had to also face and overcome. And I was also trying to build a sense of self under all of that pressure. And I think that was the biggest conflict within our family. Was my mom was like, you need to be my daughter and be here and be obedient and be my secretary and be available to me. And she was absolutely right. She needed all of those things because she didn't have much support otherwise. But I also, and I was happy to do those things, but I also wanted to be and shape my new self, you know, as a teenager and as a young woman and as a new Canadian. And I needed to fit into my society because so much of my peace derived from being social, you know, and integrating and assimilating and having Canadian kids like me and be friends with me. So that was something that we didn't understand. And of course, because we weren't taught to be vulnerable and to talk to each other, we just criticized each other, right? My mom was like, you're an awful child. You're rebellious and you don't listen. You're not here from, you know, for your family. And I was like, I just want to go out. Don't talk to me.
It's tricky. It's really tricky. I don't know if your family was similar to mine insofar as like really attached as well to their cultural roots and really made it like almost a full-time job.
How was your family attached?
It was forever like, you know, you are Arab, like, do not forget that. And you will go to Saturday school and learn Arabic, and you will spend your summers in Syria and learn Arabic, and you will eat Arabic food. And this is our home. And this is, you know, it's very like, this is who you are. I mean, but yes, you're British, but like, it was almost like a technicality, a bit more than a technicality, to be fair. But if I would say it was like, the disconnect between what my mind was and what my culture was. And that's, I suppose, also what I meant about like the balancing act of the two, holding these two cultures simultaneously within me, but not really integrated, I would say. That would come much later. And that would come after like a bit of a breakdown and figuring out, because you start to create these separations within you. There's like me at school and then there's me at home. And not that they were strict or didn't allow me my freedom and to go out. And it wasn't like that. It was just a sense of always feeling a little bit outside of the general culture around me and society around me. Just that little, you know, few inches outside, just, you know, and I think they were just so cautious and afraid. I mean, partly at the beginning, they weren't entirely sure how long they would stay here. I mean, turned out to be, you know, 40 years, but they didn't know at the beginning for sure. And then they were just very proud and very much wanting to like instill that sense of Arab identity within me.
Which makes sense, yeah.
Which makes sense, totally. And, yeah. And you know, I think as an adult now, I can appreciate it a lot more and the value that there is in that. But it was definitely difficult. It felt schizophrenic when I was younger. And it didn't feel completely whole, yeah.
Yeah, I think that also makes complete sense.
Well, it's a natural human instinct, the belonging, the yes. belonging to a tribe, the social identity that you create by attaching yourself to a particular yeah. group, whatever it is, you know. And in order to belong to a certain group, there has to be a certain uniformity, unless you happen to be the, like, we're all different group, but yeah. which I think we're part of now.
Yeah,
I mean, that's the thing. Now my group, my tribe is that we're all very different and we've kind of come to the stage where we're happy with that and celebrate it. And isn't that nice? And
so do you mean you have multicultural friends or like third culture kid friends?
Yes. Third culture kid friends or people who, even if they come from a, you know, a homogenous cultural background, have themselves perhaps come to the awareness that they're different in some other way to the dominant, you know, social norms, and therefore have gone through that process whereby you kind of break out of that need to fit in. You start to celebrate really all of the little components that make you you.
Yeah.
I suppose it's that kind of that fine balance and tension between, you know, wanting to be or accepting yourself as a unique individual, but also wanting to belong to something bigger
yeah.
and whole, because there's safety and there's love and there's comfort and there's all of that in that, right?
As human beings, we need to emotionally belong to a collective, and we'll take whatever collective, especially in the Western context, if you've been also in the background conditioned to choose that which is more similar feeling, right? Then you're going to go for the collective or the community that feels similar to you. So like in your case, a little bit like the outcast third culture group is a part of the growing pains of integrating into a new society and working out difference versus similarity and belonging and being emotionally accepted.
But you obviously did it so well that you decided to have another go at it and move to another country.
Or I'm completely insane and like love, masochistically love pain. It was definitely not an easy journey. I'm constantly going through like migration challenges, like moving to the UK, setting up a business here. One of the main reasons for why I decided to go through the pain of now migrating for a second time and going through like a really difficult process to apply for what like minimal options I had. And I was like, the only option I had of a visa back in 2012 was the entrepreneurial visa for graduates. And I thought maybe I could set up a private tutoring company and I can bring in new innovative things and make it different and sophisticated and like meaningful and technological as well as traditional and like meet all of these things that I wanted to. And it gets to be also a remedy for the somewhat awful education system that feels cold and not vulnerable.
Why education?
I'm very passionate about education, but I'm highly critical of the education system, especially in the UK. I would honestly, like knowing all the curriculums through my private tutoring company now within the last 10 years, because we worked from like year one to A-levels and then in university. So I've gotten to know basically all the subjects and courses that are taught from like year one onwards. And honestly, I would rip up so much of it and replace it with much more profound teachings in psychology and philosophy really early on. But then that would really powerfully change things. So I'm not sure if systems are ready for that, but I'm coming for them.
All right, world, you heard. Beware.
And so the idea was like emotionally intelligent tutoring and mentorship. So, and we were the first company to do that in the UK, and we've gotten awards and whatever for that. But I've seen thousands of students of like lives and hearts transform. They just became more confident and felt like someone believes in them in a truly meaningful, vulnerable way where that those conversations and that safe space is allowed. while they're doing, while they're achieving the ticks for like the tests and the exams and the pressures that the education system puts onto them. So yeah, that was the first company. And then the second one, which is much more recent and came out of the first one, which is the, again, education and training oriented company, but this time working with professionals and young people to actually do proper like training and workshop on what it means to be emotionally intelligent, why it's so necessary in 2023, and how that ties into leadership, diversity and inclusion, into building cultures at work or in schools, and essentially teaching people how to be communicative, conflict resolving, and vulnerable.
Yeah.
And being authentic.
I mean, it's incredibly impressive.
Thank you. That's very kind.
You set up your business, you set up another, and education obviously is the central part in all of this. Started off initially as tutoring, private tutoring, but gradually you've been expanding and incorporating the learnings and the readings and the knowledge that you have in psychology and most specifically emotional intelligence, which is what I really want to ask so much about. What is emotional intelligence?
There's actually an expert who coined the term, Dr. Daniel Goleman, who in the 1990s came up with this term. And he was a psychologist with a lot of experience who basically put down as the most fundamental skill that human beings can have this idea of emotional intelligence, because it ties to absolutely everything they do. So what is emotional intelligence? According to him, there are five pillars. There is self-awareness. So a human being that is successful emotionally anyway, first and foremost, has a great sense of self and awareness about the self and the complexities and layers of being human and of being a person and whatever that means. That means your identity, your culture, your upbringing. It means lots of things. So that's self-awareness. And then the second stage is an emotionally intelligent person feels comfortable feeling their emotions, which is something that we avoid culturally and worldwide, as I said earlier. So second stage of emotional intelligence is often missing, to say the least. And then on top of that, to do regulation of your emotions. So it's obviously it works in unison, right? Like if you know how to sit with your emotions and feel them genuinely as they rush through your body in any given day, time, moment, or event, then you can also sit and process them or think them through or regulate them or calm them, do some breath work. So like knowing yourself enough to know what emotions go through you and then sitting and processing them. At the third stage, probably one of my favorite stages of emotional intelligence is empathy skills.
Mm-hmm.
And I emphasize the word skills because it really truly takes a highly self-aware, emotionally regulated or emotionally available person to themselves to be able to show up, to connect to others in an aware, curious, vulnerable, and therefore empathetic, skillful way, right? So it's a lot, actually. So we use empathy so often, but and like as a general term, but it's not, it's much more skill-oriented than we think. We often think it's just a feeling, but it's not. It's a complex action. Anyway, and then the fourth pillar of emotional intelligence and what defines it is meaning and purpose. So a person that sets out to be emotionally intelligent lives a well-designed life according to their meanings and purpose. And so remember, like, number one, you're self-aware. One of the things you should be aware of are your meanings and purpose in life. And here in the fourth pillar, you put that into action. So for example, this is one of the things that I had to think about in terms of like, why am I dedicating myself to education when it was something that I was kind of running away from initially in the early stages of my career, or like avoiding it, or like being like, no, it's not serious. It turns out that the universe also had a little bit of a mission for me. I was meant to find out that education is actually my life's mission, purpose, value, meaning, everything that I do, if I'm not being ridiculous, basically, comes down to wanting to share that which I learn. I find learning so exciting. It's almost like taking a hot shower, steamy shower for me. I learn things that I'm like, oh, the world is so beautiful and it's so stunning. I just want to absorb it all and take it all into my body, quite literally. And then I want to share that out of love. And so I come across unknowingly to friends as like wanting to teach them things all the time. But it's truly my experience. I was telling a friend of mine, it's truly an expression of my love language. When I love people, I want to share that which has made me warm like a blanket. I want to share that blanket.
And so it's beautiful.
Thank you. And so like, do you see why I called my company also Fearless Knowledge? Because I think that's a fearless thing to do as well. You need to be fearless about learning, about taking that blanket onto yourself. Is almost like it's, you have to let go of your fears and accept the truth, accept knowledge, accept learning. The fifth pillar of emotional intelligence is also social intelligence. And that's the idea that the other four come together to create a socially, like a social thinker, an interconnected thinker, where there isn't immediately a sense of difference and compartmentalization between me and you, Layla. There is immediately the desire to want to know your meaning, purpose, know you as a self, to empathize with you, to want to understand your truths and to consider your truths as a part of also truths that exist in the world. That's a socially intelligent person, right? And so the idea of like diversity and all of the other, you know, social issues that we talk about, it like that all comes, like that all lives within a socially intelligent person.
How have you found the feedback or an impact in a corporate setting? You work with teams and professionals. What's the impact on them? Why are they even asking for this?
Good question. Who knows why they're asking? They're masochists like me? I don't know. Like it just, no, I'm kidding. I think it's really interesting actually that we're getting even, because a business at the end of the day, like mine, is a business. And so there needs to be a demand so that I can supply something, right? Of a service. Who knew there would ever come a time where companies and corporations would come to a person as absurd and weird as me, as layered as me, to say, can you teach us how to be better leaders for 2023? Can you show us what relational skills and developing a more positive culture that is more inclusive actually looks like within a company and within a collective? So I use the word company or collective almost like overlappingly, because that's what it is. It's a group of people as a team that have to work with each other towards a meaning or purpose that they're designing, and they need to be self-aware. They need to regulate together. They need to be able to communicate and not avoid conflict, become vulnerable. They need to discuss the meaning and purpose of everything and to be socially intelligent together. And I think during COVID, there was a big almost impetus for this, like a catalyst, because a lot of issues were happening within the, let's just say, the mind of corporations. It was going through its own mental health crisis, I think. And I have to say, in my experience so far anyway, the companies that are coming through to us, it's not usually at the top leadership that's coming for this. It's usually a couple of middle management steps down, which is very interesting because there's such an openness and curiosity towards becoming emotionally intelligent leaders at the middle management levels that there is such a resistance to that at the very top. And so breaking that glass ceiling should be an interesting endeavor in the future, but we're starting to slowly, slowly step there.
It's interesting the way you describe what you do and the needs. It's like you're a corporate therapist.
I am. Yeah. In a way, without being a therapist, actually, which is funny because I've never trained as a
corporate
therapist.
Right.
But I am a coach. So, you know, yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
I am. I'm definitely a corporate therapist or corporate coach. But I can also extend that to, for example, students in schools. I think all of these, like, I still love working with children. I still love working with young people. And in fact, I would absolutely love for more schools to pursue services like this, like through Fearless Knowledge or otherwise, to do training for their teachers, to do training for their students from a very early age. And I would even encourage primary schools to start.
So, Tanya, I want to get back to you and your culture a little bit. You grew up in Iran until you were 10, and then you moved to Canada, and you haven't lived in Iran since leaving. Do you still identify strongly with the Iranian culture? And if so, what parts of it, what practices, traditions, philosophies do you take from it to help manage your own emotional and mental well-being?
I think I mean, obviously, there is definitely an Iranian side to me. I mean, most people who truly know me at heart would definitely say, you're so Iranian in so many ways. I love hosting and I love having guests and I love being generous, but I also love being like other people being generous to me, by the way.
I will invite you for dinner.
Exactly. Wink, wink. Because I think there's such a ironic, so speaking of good and bad parts of your culture, there's also such a, you know, like similar to the Arab world, Persians come from like similar backgrounds. There's such a sense of like overgiving and generosity. But at the same time, there is I think the true essence of Persian culture, there is very much embedded the sense of reciprocity. And I think I love that aspect of being Iranian in that sense, that I constantly think about that, actually. I think, you know, you're a common like Iranian person, you'll see as being super hospitable and host-like and generous and whatever and giving. But I think deep down inside, we all know and expect reciprocity because that's also a part of our culture, which I think sometimes goes unmet in other parts of the world sometimes. Mm. So like, you know, we give and give and then the other person's like, well, I don't have that much to give you, so I'm just going to take. So... So I've definitely experienced that as an Iranian raised person in Canada or in England sometimes. Which is sometimes why my appeal also goes to people who understand reciprocity, whatever culture they come from.
I mean, are you talking about that in a general sense, or do you find that that reciprocity and socializing actually helps your mental well-being or emotional well-being?
Oh, 100%. Yeah, it's such a big thing. I love being a host and being generous and giving and nurturing. It's just such a deep part of my character. But I also am frankly tired of saying, no, I'll be the giver. Like, I love giving people too. And it provides me with good mental health, that sense of reciprocity. Because to only be leaking fuel is never good for anybody. That actually drains you. It's also not emotionally intelligent. Remember the third element of emotional intelligence, which was empathy? That is the skill. Reciprocity is the skill in empathetic living. Is that like when you are, you know, in any circumstance as a friend in my life, Layla, then I need to think about how to also bring joy into your life whenever I am afforded the opportunity to. And when you're hurting, I'm hurting along with you. And, you know, so like it's that duality that's important for mental health.
Yeah, no, understood. Khalas, don't worry. An invitation is in the post to you.
I'm so glad I set that up. Thank you very much.
Right? It's very well, skillfully done, I must say.
Thank you.
I walked straight into that. But yeah, no, I'm,
I would like some shakshuka, please, in the morning. And I would like for lunch some, can I put a menu together?
This is a whole day thing, I see. Okay, yes. Yeah, sure. Why not?
Well, yeah. You know what?
I'm happy to. I would love to. Absolutely love to. And yeah, we'll definitely do that.
When we give a lot. Okay, lady?
Understood.
You didn't wait for my initial invitation. You know, I should have invited you first.
Ooh, that's right? True.
And thanks for this lovely podcast and the opportunity you've afforded me to speak nonstop to your ears. But I should
treat
you.
It's been great.
And then I will expect some beautiful shakshuka awaiting me thereafter.
100%. The good news is, in either way, we're eating and we're eating well. And
yes,
that
please.
Makes me very happy.
I actually have saliva in my mouth because I'm such a foodie. So
I'm a little bit hungry. Yeah.
Me too.
I think it's time.
Let's go eat.
It's time. Let's go eat.
Come over.
Tanya. Thank you for listening to this episode. Check out the show notes for more details about my wonderful guests, including where you can find them on social media. If you enjoyed listening to this, please do spread the good word, share with friends, family, cousins, and colleagues, and please, please, please like and leave a review on whatever platform you are listening to this podcast. Your support is crucial for the show's success, and a couple of clicks from you will mean the world to me. Go to my website, laylamaghribi.com, and follow me on Instagram and Twitter for more news on future episodes.